Hey everybody, I'd like you to join us in welcoming a new sponsor this week, which is Square. Now, you, like I, might know Square for their mobile card swiping solution that they used to have back in the day. This little thing you plug into your phone, that go into your headphone jack, and you could swipe credit cards. Yeah, well, Square is so much more now. They make it as simple as possible to start taking payments on your website. You can take payments online, in-app, and of course, in-person as well. You can accept debit, credit, and even these custom Square gift cards that are customized for your business, which sounds awesome. On the web, you can use Square Payments to fully customize the payment experience, so you can make the UI match the look and feel of your site exactly, so it doesn't feel like some off-the-shelf solution. You can even set up digital wallets like Apple Pay, Google Pay, and MasterPass, all in one swift go. Now, they know that this is a show for developers, so I'm going to give you a developer link right now. They want you to get started and check out developer.squareup.com/docs/payment-form/overview. You can peruse the docs and see just how easy it is to set up a custom payment form on your website. Hey man, how's it going?
It is pretty good, actually.
Good to hear.
Sort of a interesting or a little bit of an off week for me, I suppose, because I'm down in Santa Cruz for the week. So I don't have my office. I don't have my standing desk. A little bit out of sorts. But other than that, pretty good. Really productive, actually. I had some pretty ambitious goals for the week, and I feel like I accomplished them. So that felt really good.
You're kind of in like the workcation mindset. No distractions, that kind of thing.
I'm still doing the do not disturb stuff that I think we talked about last week, and just sort of checking Slack when I feel like I need to. I've actually been doing more Pomodoro technique this week, which has been really helpful. So I've had more of a hard time concentrating because, again, I'm out of my element. I'm not in my office. I'm sitting on a fireplace ledge with the fold-up table that's like just too tall for it.
Oh no.
That's my desk. And yeah, so I'm at Jamie's mom's house while she's out of town. We're house sitting, and I gave her an ultra wide monitor way back, and so I'm using that, and it's not four, and this is like the dumbest thing to complain about, but it's not a 4K monitor. So lots of small subconscious sort of adjustments. So I found that like getting back to the Pomodoro technique and just focusing 25 minutes at a time has been helpful.
Are you doing that subconsciously? Do you have like an app or a timer or something to help you?
Yeah, I've been using an app called Be Focused Pro. I've had it for quite a while now. And so the reason I use that one specifically is because you can use it on your computer and your phone or your Apple Watch, and it syncs across them. So that way, like if the timer goes off and it's time for a break, you can get up and not have to set a different timer on your phone or try to remember that way, which has been nice. I don't necessarily strictly adhere to the 5 minute break in between, but I think like having a running timer has been really helpful this week.
It's really interesting. I've read about it. I've never actually tried to implement it in my workflow. I intrinsically feel like if I don't have, you know, minimum of 2+ hours to work on something, like it's a waste of time even bothering to get in it.
Yeah.
Get that way with video games sometimes too, but that's besides the point. I don't know how I would handle knowing that I have a guaranteed distraction 25 minutes from this moment. Makes it that, but I don't know.
I think more what I'm doing right now is more conducive to that. I'm not necessarily doing a ton of deep work right now. I'm sort of sprinting through a bunch of fruits of what was deep work. So did a lot of thinking and writing in terms of organization and how I like road mapping, right? So this second app that I'm working on, road mapping that. And so now I'm sort of knocking out the roadmap pieces. And the pieces happen to be small enough to where those 25 minutes, I can sort of blast through pieces and get up. And I think that's why another reason why I was having trouble focusing is because it's a lot of small bits. And it can be difficult for me to sort of hone in on them. And for me, if I have like one big task or a couple of big tasks, I can focus on that more easily. But if it's a lot of small, sort of like a bag of things that need to get done, it's harder for me to stay focused on those. So I think specifically this week, that's why it's been helping me.
I guess that makes sense, especially if you're jumping around and doing a lot of context switching and, like I said, doing a lot of small tasks. I could see how that could definitely sort of force you to get things done and do things in a compartmentalized way. I guess that's kind of the idea, right?
Yeah, that's the idea. It's like intense. I guess the other part of the idea is that, like, during those 25 minutes, you don't do anything else. So you don't answer the phone, you don't answer Slack, you don't answer text message, you don't answer email, whatever. So I think the other benefit is that it sort of pushes the notification checking into like a defined time. I feel like if I do have things on Do Not Disturb for too long, it starts to make me anxious in the back of my mind. Like, is the site even up? Is it working? Even though I know it is, because my inbox isn't blown up. But does that make sense? Though it sort of like helps you it gives you specific times in which you can do specific things that might be distracting. Maybe that's a better way to put it.
Yeah, I think I mentioned either last week or the week before that I really don't believe that people are good at multitasking just intrinsically. So this is kind of a way to have your cake and eat it too, because you are focused, you're not multitasking, and you're not trying to like answer five different people at once and work and do all this other stuff. But you are multitasking because over the course of 8 hours, normal workday, you can get a lot of different things done just in time division multiplexed slices.
Yeah. And this week I spent a lot of time debating myself, and I won't go into it because I want to talk about what's been on your plate, but sort of coming up with a design, like a database designer, like a data structure, and then sending it to a few people, asking for feedback, and then having internal struggles and debates and that whole problem. So finally settled those things on, I think it was like Thursday morning, and Thursday and Friday, as of Friday when I left, the thing that I had been envisioning all week is fully functional, and Jackie, who's doing the front end of this, was just able to pick it up and use it, which was awesome.
Yeah, we should definitely talk more about that at some point, because I really think it's really interesting what you've been cooking up over there in the DK Labs.
DK Labs, yeah. I guess, yeah, my approach to classifications and categorizing and tagging, I suppose. Not necessarily tagging, but more categorizing things. I'm really happy with what I came up with, especially after using it. So we'll talk about that.
I feel like we spent more time discussing it than you did actually implementing it.
Yeah. Because, yeah, I mean, it's really not a complicated... The implementation is pretty straightforward. I think the possible edge cases, I think, are maybe what was more of a hang up. But the implementation, like, I mean, adding the tables and stuff was easy. Heck, I mean, even I think like the thing I spent the least amount of time on was even making it so that way you can just literally pass an array of categories in for a product, and everything is inserted as it's needed to be inserted. It's pretty like Jackie was like, that was it. That's all I need to do. I said, yeah. If you omit something, the association is going to be gone. If you include everything, it'll be there. If you pass an empty list, it'll get rid of all the associations. Really, I'm just exposing put ASOC behind the scenes.
I was just going to say that's like Ecto 101 almost. Like, it makes that so powerful.
And what felt even better, I suppose, is this is one of the first times where I didn't have to like second guess, wait, what is put ASOC and what is cast ASOC again? Like, I just knew. I was like, oh, this is what I need to do. And then it was done. And then that was it. I was like, okay, well, it's 4:30 on a Friday. I guess I'm done. You know, it wasn't one of those had to pull myself away at 5 o'clock sort of scenarios. But yeah, I think like coming into Ecto, especially from other frameworks, I started looking at like cast and put ASOC, like, wow, this seems so magical. And it's almost like too simple. It can't be that simple, right? It's almost too simple and confusing. And what 3 years later, I'm like, no, it is that simple. And that's how it should be. So it felt really good to be at that place.
That's cool. I've been twisting and bending Ecto to all kinds of weird use cases with live view and keeping state and parameters and forms and search forms and embedded schemas and all that stuff. It's, man, Ecto really is a hammer. And everything seems like a nail at this point.
Let's talk about what you got going on, because we've sort of been dancing around it for a couple of weeks now, and I really want to hear about all the LiveU stuff you've got going on.
So, LiveU. Man, dude, I feel like LiveU is the future, man. Like, I'm really trying to not oversell it, but man, it's freaking so nice to work with for a lot of different use cases, man. Let me back up a little bit. Currently, Remote Ham Radio is a Rails application. The way we do, we have a subscription service, so like you pay yearly for access, and then you also pay monthly based off your usage for that particular month, right? So depending on how many minutes you spend on the air at however many cents per minute, we total that up, and every 30 days you get an invoice and you pay it. And we do all that through FreshBooks, which FreshBooks, for a solo, you know, small businesses, independent people, I use it for my own personal stuff. FreshBooks is great. The new interface is okay, but overall it's just a great product and worth the whatever $25 a month. It's pays for itself in time saved and money collected,
right?
That you forgot about.
Quite literally will pay for itself.
Yeah. And when we started the business, when we started running radio, this is like, it was great because we did everything kind of by hand. And obviously that does not scale, right? I mean, once you get hundreds of users, it becomes a real nightmare. So FreshBooks does support recurring billing, but it doesn't support recurring billing with like automatic payment. So every month that someone gets a bill, they have to manually put in their payment information. It's a nightmare, dude. Like, I can't even imagine that people are sticking around for that. It blows my mind that no one has complained about that. It's a real thing that people do, is they put in their credit card every month and or PayPal or whatever. And then I got to keep everything in sync with a third party. And then I have to keep track of, FreshBooks has recurring profiles for our yearly subscriptions. Right now, we're just like, if you don't want to renew, we're going to send an invoice. You just ignore it and it will automatically close your account, which is a terrible system because now you've got a bunch of invoices sitting in your billing system that are just outstanding forever because you never clean them up. It's not ideal, man. It's a nightmare. We've got like 17 different documents in Basecamp showing who's grandfathered into what plans, who renewed when, how they paid, where they signed up, what plan they're on, plus all the stuff in the app itself with permissions, and then that's not even really tied to the subscription at all. Like, it just knows that you paid your invoice, but it doesn't really know what plan you're on. We have to manually, like, it's a mess, dude. So I've tried to, obviously it makes sense for the business to pull this sort of recurring subscription model and the metered billing. And we also have a concept of credit, which is not dollars credit. It's like airtime credit. It's like minutes instead of dollars, right?
Okay.
So there's lots of different balances and recurring things and metered billing. Lots of really kind of specific requirements for our business that we really just wanted to pull in-house. And, you know, I attempted to do this multiple times before. I tried it with Stripe originally because Stripe's model was actually very conducive to this. Their API is very good. Like, it turns out. Stripe does handle subscriptions and metered billing very well. So basically what they'll do is you can set up a plan where, like, they'll create the invoice every month, but they'll leave the invoice open and send you a webhook and be like, hey, we created this invoice. You have 24 hours to throw a bunch of crap on it, and then we'll attempt to collect on it. So that's a way you can do metered billing.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah. It's not really a hack, but it's a good way to handle that. So basically, if a user were signing up, we would create a yearly subscription for them, and we'd also create a monthly subscription that's $0 and kind of behind the scenes, right? And then the $0 subscription would trigger every month, create the invoice, webhook, then we add on their monthly charge to that. So, but that didn't work for various reasons. Syncing things up was difficult, subscriptions, and also big thing is like half of our users pay with PayPal, and Stripe does not accept PayPal.
Right.
So that we really don't want to lose people because of that. I played around with Chargebee. Chargebee is really billed as this recurring billing solution to get you off the ground. It was okay. It was just overall, it was not flexible enough and also insanely expensive. So did not end up landing on Chargebee. And I also really hesitated for a long time, really trying to do this myself. it seemed overly complicated. Like, why reinvent the wheel? It's never really, this is kind of a good solution for a hosted service. It's complicated. You don't want to have to do it yourself. And you really want to get it right. You know, anything involving money, you know, is nerve-wracking to have to worry about getting it correct.
Yeah, you often don't get a second chance when it comes to money things.
Yeah, and we have a pretty loyal customer base. You know, if we mess things up, we'll always fix it for people. You know, it's never a problem, but you don't want to be in that situation in the first place.
So what did you end up landing on?
Well, so against all my better judgment, just like you shouldn't write authentication, just like you shouldn't write your own encryption schemes, you probably should not write your own recurring custom billing solution. But that's what I'm doing. What it came down to was our business has not really changed. We don't need the flexibility. You know, our business model has not changed in years. So we know the sort of very core feature set that we need. I kind of outlined it, right? Recurring billing, metered billing, PayPal, credit card, and then our own sort of like credit balance system. All those things, you know, you don't need to recreate the world and offer all the features that Stripe offers, because then you're just going to recreate Stripe. It's okay if you know the scope of your project to just tackle it and just check off the box. And so that's what I've been doing. I've added, I'm still using Rails to create my migrations because it's kind of like the master of the database right now. Subscription models, invoice models, plans. Actually, I didn't even make bottles, tables, and database for the plans. I just hard code them in an Elixir module. I just have a big array of plain old structs that outline all the plans, and they have IDs and they have values and stuff, and they can say what you can upgrade to, what you can downgrade to, the prices, the names. It's not a database. It's basically static. It's never going to change. I don't care. It's just an array of structs.
Right. I mean, you're starting with the simplest possible implementation and running with it.
Yeah. So that was pretty good. I spent a lot of time in Notion outlining it. I drew a couple of like state machines showing how invoices can be rejected or paid or whatever. Basically, the whole goal is to the only third-party API piece of this should be the payment processing. Obviously, we're not going to do that ourselves, but I opted not to rely on a third-party service for everything surrounding that, right?
Right. So essentially, you're doing everything yourself in terms of how much should this person owe, and then you're using a third-party charging service to actually do the transaction.
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah. The service that we landed on is actually Braintree, because they're a PayPal company and they support PayPal and credit cards out of the box. So that was what was a good fit for our business. And I haven't actually looked at their API yet, but I do know that just a couple months ago, they launched a GraphQL API for their service, and it looks pretty legit. So I'm really excited to actually consume a third-party GraphQL API for once.
Oh, yeah, that would be cool. I don't, you know, think of it beyond, like, say, Gatsby or GridZone. I've never actually consumed another third-party GraphQL service either.
Yeah, GitHub has one now, too, I think. It's supposed to be pretty good. So that's where I'm at with that. So I've got a bunch of modules and tests, and I actually wrote some tests for this one. Can you believe that? Like, I'm really, really going all in on this.
I like that.
But the fun part was actually doing the back-end component for this, the actual administrative interface.
So is this where the live view part comes in, or?
Yeah, exactly. So a while ago, I was working with a developer, and he was working on some React stuff together. And he's like, oh, like the whole admin interface for RHR now is just static, plain old controller pages and stuff. He's like, oh, it'd be so cool if the admin interface was in React. And I'm like, no, it's never going to happen. Like, you do the calculus on it, it's not worth the effort to make a front end, make an API, make a API that talks to. It's, you know, when you've got something that works, it's just not worth that energy. But LiveView takes all of the guesswork out of that, all the extra work. Like, you really only have to write something once, and you don't have to worry about, you know, you can still get the advantage of an interactive component without writing any JavaScript, without writing an API layer, and all that stuff, right? So that's been just a major boon. I mean, it's just really simple stuff. Like I'm on the users list and I want to filter by users. I just start typing and it filters in real time, right? Like when you go to make a change to a user account, just that little section of the page becomes its own little live view, and you can edit their email address or billing address or whatever. Just a little live view. You hit edit, you type some changes, you hit save, that's persisted to the database. Just that little section of the page, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems like a part of the reason, you know, it seems to me that people like to choose Spaz is because it gives them a lot of flexibility to, say, build things. Despite how the, you know, the API is structured, you can sort of build things how you want and use the API how you want, right? Another reason that people seem to choose Spaz is because they can, you know, componentize the UI. Componentize is not a real word, but like, you know, wrap up the bits of UI into reasonable pieces. And I guess on my side, it's always sort of felt clunky to do that in like a server-side templating language, like, you know, EEX or embed. Is it embedded Elixir? EEX, what does that stand for?
You know, I don't actually know.
I think it's embedded Elixir, but even like ERB with like Rails or whatever, it doesn't feel quite the same. It always feels like there's more hoops you have to jump through, I suppose, as compared to like, say, view components. But it seems like live view sort of, you get the ease of componentizing your UI back. It feels more like you're using the framework to your advantage as opposed to sort of fighting the framework, if that makes any sort of sense. I feel like when I'm working on server-side render stuff, I always feel like I'm fighting things a little bit, especially when it comes to forms.
Yeah, and forms are definitely a big thing that I think are greatly enhanced by this. For example, being able to utilize your change set functions and all those validations that you've built out on the server, like, you can use those for free. You don't have to write validations twice.
Right.
You can even hit the database if you want to validate stuff. Like, who cares? A database is fast. Live view is fast. WebSockets are fast. Like, it's good enough for a lot of cases. What I've been using it for in terms of form stuff is actually, so for example, a picture, a very complicated filtering thing. You can maybe, it's got a search field. Maybe it's got a couple drop downs and you can like filter this list, right? What I do is I make that, define that as an embedded schema, basically a struct, but I kind of define what the types of those queries are. Maybe I'll do, you know, search query, status, you know, some kind of drop down, whatever, strings, ints, you know, limit only 50 results or 100 results or 200 results, whatever. Then I can, what do I get out of that? I get change sets. I can pass a change set to a form. I can build a form really easily with a form helper. I can cast the results back to that change set function. And if I really, really wanted to, I haven't actually tried this yet, but I think it's going to work really well. I can just pass that whole friggin' schema right into my context function. Just be like, this is a giant params object. Give me my results back. Right? Like, have that be the single argument.
That's really interesting. So you're using embedded schemas for this, right? Meaning that the data that you're working with doesn't have anything to do with the database. And at that point, because you're using embedded schema, you get the Ecto usage, or you get the change set usage for free. And that means that if you define things on the server side, you can just use them because you're using LiveView and you don't have to sort of implement that via, like, say if you're using Absinthe, you'd have to build the whole Absinthe interface, right? So you'd have to define the input objects and everything. So yeah, you are skipping a whole step in that you don't have to build up the front-end API like you talked about. But I think that's really compelling to me, because I wouldn't have thought to just make arbitrary, you know, I think like in my mind, Ecto always comes back to, it's a ORM, but it's not really. It's a generalized data manager that has, you know, you can use it with the database. So that's really a neat way of using it, just with embedded schemas and change sets. That's, I like that.
Yeah, it's really, really eye-opening. You might call them, like, I'm using air quotes here, form objects.
Yeah.
You might see that nomenclature.
Form objects, that's a good way. Yeah, that's one thing I've heard of before. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking, like, one thing when I was doing Node stuff, when I was using that Walmart library, Happy.js. I don't want to say Walmart library. I know that Walmart uses Happy.js, but they have a library called Joy, J-E-A-U-X, I think it's called. I'll put it in the show notes. But anyway, it's sort of like the validation layer of Ecto change sets, in that you sort of define the requirements and then you can use that wherever you need to, whether you're putting it on a controller, putting it in front of an API, using it to validate data that's getting sent to you. I really liked that pattern. I think that was the first time I saw that. And then coming to Ecto, I was like, oh, that feels exactly like it. And I recommend that people do a blog post search on Google for using change sets with just regular structs or regular like embedded schemas, because there are a few good posts out there that talk about, hey, you can use Ecto change sets as like sort of a generalized data validation library.
Yeah, and there are a couple out there for Elixir. I think I can't think of the names off the top of my head, but there are a couple libraries out there that do this. But you know, you've already got the dependency in your application, and you already kind of have the tool set at your disposal. I don't know. It's surprising how good of a fit that was for. And I use that pattern all over the place now.
We use it a lot too. Even so, for like this new stuff I'm working on, you know, a big part of it's like importing data from CSVs, and it's all change set based. So I have a couple of different mappings for different vendors that we're working with. And mapping is essentially just a function that calls a specialized change set for that specific vendor. It worked out really, really well. I basically just have one module that is a behavior, and it also defines the default sort of casting like pounds to grams, or casting different dimensions to other things, or casting dollars to cents or whatever. And so when I go to create a new mapping, I just use this base mapper and then maybe implement one or two custom functions and then tell it which fields I care about, and I get all the change set stuff. So out the other side, if there's errors, we can just serialize the change set errors into JSON and put that in a database and use that as a report. It worked out so well.
That's cool. That's great. Just talking a little about Ecto too, I also dove really into Ecto Multi for these transactions. You know, create an invoice, add these line items, attempt the payment. Hey, did any of those things fail? Roll the whole thing back, you know. Ecto Multi for composing those kind of operations. Maybe I want to create an invoice without paying. That's just a different multi, you know. Stuff like that, I'm really starting to get on the bandwagon for. It's really, really powerful. It's literally transactional operations. So that's been really nice as well.
I think one thing that I really like, and I want to use a little bit more with Ecto Multi specifically, is the ability to sort of compose multis together. So like you said, you can sort of decide, do I want to charge it now? Do I want to charge it later? And you can basically take your whole process, your whole charging and tallying process, put them into functions that sort of adhere to the Ecto Multi shape, right? So basically, I think if they're arbitrary functions, they have to return a tag tuple like okay and whatever, or error and whatever message. As long as you do that, you can sort of pipe together a multi that runs in a single transaction as many different ways as you want to.
Yeah, I think it would be cool to have that kind of model for business logic, just generic business logic. I think that's out there. I think there's a thing for that, but I think about that sometimes. Keeps me up at night.
I mean, it seems like to me like you're being really productive with this whole setup with Live View. Like, you've been sending me screenshots and animated GIFs, and everything looks really good. It seems like you're just being really productive.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. It's an admin backend. Literally three people in the whole world are going to look at this. Does it need to be reactive thing? Can't you just type your filters in and just hit enter and do a page refresh like an animal? Sure, you could do that. But it's literally no more work to do it the Live View way, and it's better. And obviously a lot of these components, eventually, when I get to working on the user's view into this application, a lot of this is going to be reused for that thing. For example, our invoice view, right? Like, I can search and query invoices and stuff. Like, users are going to want to do that too. So I'll make it generic and I'll bring it over, and then the users will have a nice experience for that as well, and it can get shared. So this is not just a yak shaving exercise. This is like using the tools, minimal amount of work for a large amount of gain. I'm going to get that reuse out of it. And it's just cool. It just feels cool. You know, it feels like leveling up a little bit and having that tool in your toolbox. I even found a bug in Live View when I was doing this. And basically I would try to do these transitions between these two different states of a particular Live View. And, you know, you do these signs and re-render it, but for whatever reason, the view wouldn't update in the browser. It thought the view was exactly the same, and so it didn't push any diffs to the browser. And it had to do with a specific way my templates were laid out. Anyway, I went back and forth with Chris McCord over a couple hours on Slack when he had, you know, 5 seconds to listen to me complain. I made a minimal repo to recreate the issue and showed exactly, created an issue on Phoenix Live View with the repo, explained the thing, and in 2 hours, Jose had fixed it and closed it.
That's wild.
They're out of control over there, man.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they're killing it over there too, but I think that also the fact that you made a minimal repo for it probably was a huge help as well, like being a good citizen, an open source citizen.
I'd like to think so. It's so funny because like I feel like I put all this work in and I wrote this whole elaborate bug report and explained, here's what I see, here's what I think is the problem, here's all the things I tried, and Jose's like closed with the link to the commit. I mean, just pure efficiency there. So hopefully that helped.
Yeah, that's great. So you're getting pretty granular with your components over there. So it seems like you said, you have a sort of a search input with a dropdown or a dropdown of some sort, and you're wanting to use that across pages. Obviously, if we're doing React or Vue, that would sort of probably be its own sort of base like dropdown component. Are you getting that granular with Live View as well?
I haven't actually gotten that far yet. I've done that a little bit. I played with live components a little bit, and live components are interesting because they are a way of sort of encapsulating some view logic, but they still run in the parent process of the live view. So they're kind of, they don't have access to the live view itself, but they share some state with it and they can communicate with it. So I haven't done any live component stuff really, but if you wanted to do that, that's how I would do it. But live component would be like very granular kind of components. Like you want a really fancy drop down with searching or something, right? But you want to be able to customize it.
Right.
But most of my live views are honestly just full pages. I mean, there's a layout wrapped around it, but then I actually mount most of my live views directly on the router.
Okay.
Which also has a benefit, which I didn't mention, of when I'm doing these search queries and typing in real time and changing filters, the URL updates, so you get a real URL with parameters that you can share with someone, and they paste it in, and
that's great.
They get the same form. Oh, it's awesome.
That's always a pain for me redoing that in JavaScript land. Yeah, it seems like there are a number, especially for Vue or Vuex specifically, there are a number of plugins that might do something similar, but a lot of them have lots of bugs opened, and you know, sometimes it's like you don't always want to go with the most generalized approach, right? You need something a little bit more specialized or a little bit more simple. So that's always one nit that I have, is redoing that all the time. So that's really cool. I think in the Phoenix LiveView docs, they actually recommend, that's a recommended way of mounting components, is via the router. But I didn't realize that you would just sort of get that for free.
Yeah, it's a little bit of work to wire it up because you have to really be explicit about what URL you push and when you push it. But once I figured that out, it was like, okay, I haven't broken the web. Like if I click on a user and I go to their profile and then I hit the back button, right, it'll actually go back.
It should work, right? Yeah.
Which that got me so frustrated. I kept going back and I was like, oh, everything's all different. And so I was like, I have to learn this now.
Yeah. Yeah, but it seems like just basically it's not like you had to wire up a whole thing to make it work. You sort of just needed to learn the best way to follow, or the best way to implement. It wasn't that you had to write something custom or kind of reinvent the wheel to make that happen.
No, I will say though that it did feel, every time you kind of implement these little features, especially in Live View, where you've got a stateful component and there's a WebSocket, and like the model, the mental model for this is not really, I feel, well-defined, because it's not ground that's been tread on before, right? Model view controller, okay, I know what you're talking about. CRUD, I know what you mean. REST, I know what you mean. But this live view thing is this weird hybrid where you've got some state, but you also have a view, and so the live view has kind of view logic, but also controller logic, and how do you keep, like, what state do you actually keep track of? And obviously latency is a thing you have to think about, like, you know, if you can tolerate it and how much, and disconnections. There's a lot of questions around sort of designing these components and when you do certain things to achieve certain results. It's really hard to like say thing X is a solution to problem Y You just kind of have to kind of know the tool set and know when to apply those things tactically. So I don't know if I get any more specific than that, but that is kind of a shortcoming of it. It's like you really got to know the API and have those docs up in a tab somewhere.
Yeah. I that's sort of a good thing in my opinion as of right now, though. Like I kind of like that way of working where it sort of forces you to learn the tool itself as opposed to learn someone else's interpretation of the tool, if that makes sense. I feel like a lot of times often I go to blogs or I read articles and you're reading someone might understand how to use the tool better than you do, but also you're reading their interpretation of the tool and you're also getting the information through their context, the problems they're trying to solve, the projects they're working on, and maybe your context is a little bit different. And so I've been trying to, instead of jump to like looking for a blog post for something, writing down the thing I'm trying to do and jumping into the docs and see if I can find it mentioned. So that's one reason why I really enjoy the Elixir approach to documentation, I suppose. So, you know, especially in wiring up more complicated database design things, I really like how Ecto sort of walks you through their approach to polymorphism, why they think it's the right way, why they think other ways probably aren't as efficient or the best way to do things. And in fact, they advocate for the simplest way of doing the polymorphism until you need something bigger, right? I really appreciated that versus I'm sure I could have landed, especially early on, I could have landed on a blog that was like, all right, well, Rails does polymorphism this way and we can make Ecto do it that way too. Sort of a situation, right?
Right.
Does that make any sense though? What I mean by like reading someone else's information, like, yeah, blog, I don't think blogging is bad by any means, like share that information, share your knowledge, but also know when you're reading other people's information and knowledge that a lot of times it can come through their context, their way of understanding things. And it's important to develop that for yourself too.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the issues with LiveView is that people have a kind of preconceived notion of what it is, and that's usually wrong, right? People are like, oh, it's like React, but you don't have to write JavaScript. No, that's yeah. Actually wrong. You know, oh, it's like Ajax, but it's not like that either. For example, I was helping someone in the Slack today. They're like, oh, they were using Bootstrap buttons, and the Bootstrap buttons, you can apply these like data hyphen attributes to some things to like inject some fancy little JavaScript to like have a toggle button or something. And so they're like, well, I click this toggle button, but the state changes and it changes back. I'm like, well, remember, LiveView doesn't know like the DOM. It doesn't know about the state of the DOM. It doesn't know about JavaScript you're injecting in there. You can't use Bootstrap's magic little JavaScript. You have to just rely on LiveView state to render your buttons correctly or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something like that. And like, that's one of those things where, again, you come in with, this is what I know. This is what I think is going to happen. And without really an intimate knowledge, it can be a real uphill battle.
Yeah, that makes sense. And jumping into that a little bit with Tailwind, when I was using LiveView a bit, Tailwind made that really easy because I would just drop some classes in and then, you know, do an if or something in EX and call it a day. But I hadn't thought about using something like Bootstrap or something that relies on having the JavaScript sort of always running and watching the DOM for changes to do that sort of stuff. That is a lot more of a manual process.
Yeah, and they're just really not compatible with each other. You know, if you wanna do Vue over here and LiveView over here, that's okay. But you gotta keep them on opposite sides of the ring.
Yeah, and I guess you have the Phoenix LiveView hooks, so you can call into JavaScript libraries. But that doesn't really feel like that's what it should be for either. It shouldn't be for small updates to the DOM. You know, it seems like that's made more for like if you have to have a JavaScript plugin that runs like a charting library or something big that controls a lot of the page. Like that's what it seems to me it would be made for.
One thing I think would be really interesting would be some hook or some kind of escape hatch, some way to sort of bide your time between something that can happen immediately, but then, you know, obviously I have to wait to see that change happen. Or maybe you just kind of assume that change is going to be successful, and so you just update the view with what you assume is going to be the new state in 150 milliseconds from now.
So like optimistic UIs at that point?
Optimistic UI, that's the word I'm searching for, thank you. It would be cool if there was some kind of built-in solution for that. I don't know if that's out of scope of LiveView. Maybe there's some kind of plugin. But that seems to me like a big win that solves, again, like you're kind of solving 80% of people's problems. It's like you want it to be responsive, but you still want this sort of server rendered kind of guarantee that things are right. Maybe if it's wrong, maybe you optimistically assume the wrong thing, it could fail and you could do something about that. But
yeah,
for most use cases, you know, we do that all the time, Road Home Radio, right? Everything's WebSockets and you're changing your frequencies with a mouse. Like, we're not going to wait for the radio to tell us that you changed the frequency. We just update the UI and there's a timer and we just assume that, you know, we don't update the display for a second or two. We give the radio time to catch up.
Right. It's like the difference. It's like the difference between you drag the knob and instead of the knob following your mouse, dragging it, waits for the server response. So it feels very laggy versus you drag the knob and the knob changes and then suddenly changes back because some sort of error happened.
Yeah, exactly. Which again, shouldn't happen, but I think the optimistic thing is the right thing to do in most cases. So it'd be cool to see some kind of first party support for that kind of pattern. Cause I think it is very, very common. I think those are the kind of problems that Chris is interested in solving.
Yeah, that is sort of a generalized concern. And I think optimistic UI sort of stuff was what I heard a lot of people talking about originally when I would mention LiveView was, you know, what happens if you're under heavy load and someone clicks a button and the button takes longer than normal? Like, there's no sort of way to let them know that something's happening. The UI just sort of stops responding until that request comes back. Even though it's happening behind the scenes, it's still going to sort of pause on them, and that could be really jarring to users.
Yeah, especially if it's slow and they keep clicking it just exacerbates the problem.
Yeah, it makes
it
worse, right? And especially
hit F5.
Yeah, and especially if it's supposed to be something idempotent like paying their invoice, right?
It's the worst. Yeah. Did it go? Should I click it again?
Yeah, I mean, you would think that you wouldn't have to worry about like not refreshing your browser or something after paying an invoice, but I've seen those on sites pretty recently. You pay for something and it's like, do not refresh, do not navigate away, do not, you know, pass go and collect $200. Otherwise you might actually be paying us $400 instead, you know? Yeah. That sort of stuff isn't, it's just not a good experience for users, right?
It's good for Mr. Moneybags though.
Sure. Yeah. But then, you know, I don't think, I guess you're not using Stripe, but I was going to say, like, you know, you're having to refund money and then you're losing money on the fees, processing fees and stuff, but.
Oh no. I mean, that's definitely one of the things I was really concerned about with building this whole billing thing was the edge cases, right?
Mm-hmm.
Doing refunds, partial refunds, failed charges are like kind of, those are kind of no quantity. You could deal with them and fail in a nice way. But once payments are made and how do you deal with like, I've got an invoice, but like this person's obviously never going to pay me. I just want to close it out. And so it's not on our books anymore, but I kind of want to keep it around for historical purposes, right? Stuff like that. But I think in terms of refunds, which are a real thing that happens, I'm just going to hand wave it and just do it through, just have it be a manual process for now. Go into the Braintree UI, refund the user, and then manually go to RHR, close the invoice. Like, because I don't know enough about how that system works yet to even confidently make a decision about that. I feel like just doing it by hand for now. It's so rare. As long as we have a procedure for it, I think it'll be fine.
And I think that's probably even better approach as well for quite a while, because if you have a refund, especially as a small company, you probably want to know about it and know exactly why the refund's happening. There's like part of the process around that is not only just handling the actual refund portion of it, but also understanding why it's happening and is there something you can change? Is it a quality control thing? Is the user misunderstanding something? You know, there's a lot of questions that can be asked around refunds that probably might not be asked unless it's more of a manual process.
For sure. It's never automated. I mean, we always manually have to do it anyways today. So it's not really any different. The way I'm trying to envision this is like, even if it doesn't cover all of our bases, it's still light years ahead of whatever we have right now. You know, if we have to evolve stuff over time, as long as it's correct for now and we don't overcharge people, we don't double charge people, You know, taxes I haven't even really thought about. Taxes are a thing I have to think about somehow. But like, besides like the, even taking the edge case into account, it's still going to be just this massive improvement. And we kind of like to take the approach, we like to take everything as in-house as possible. We don't really want to have any external dependencies if we can help it in terms of services we rely on. I think that's just a natural inclination of probably most companies. You don't always have that luxury, but in this case, we definitely can. And so, yeah, this will all be worth it in the end. Again, even if it's a little limiting at first, even if it takes a little couple of tries to get it right, it's not the end of the world. I think our customers will be happy. And I have a great idea for the migration process as well. You know, we don't want to do like just shut down the Rails app and migrate over and over. That's not feasible, because what if things go wrong? Mm-hmm. Basically, it built into the back end of the admin app, there's going to be a one-time like migration page where it's like, okay, bring up this user. Here's all their current information on the left side. Here's what we're going to create on the right-hand side. And you can tweak it and then just hit go. And then it will set some flag in their user record. And then next time they log in, they'll get the beautiful new backend interface instead of the old one. We'll just redirect them over or something like that. So that way we can gradually bring people over one at a time and not have to worry about shooting ourselves in the foot with a bazooka.
Feature flag it in a way.
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, that sounds like a good approach to me, honestly. I mean, you obviously know the domain of what you need to do or the features that you need to provide and how it should work. And you have a pretty specialized use case. So I think that makes complete sense. And like you said, I think like the gradual improvements over time is what matters most, right? Like that's probably the most important thing, is that you're able to make small adjustments, I suppose. And I guess another benefit too is that, you know, if there are lots of changes, you can sort of roll with them. So one thing that isn't fun about Design Collective is that when it first rolled out, we used the Connect platform, and Stripe has since made another, like, way better Connect onboarding flow that we can't use. We would have to basically have everyone re-sign or reconnect their accounts to Stripe and go through the Stripe onboarding again, which would never happen. They're not going to do it. So we're sort of just stuck with the original Stripe Connect onboarding, and there's not much we can do about it.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. You definitely don't. Yeah, you got to ride that line, right? You know, as we mentioned at the beginning of this year with our turn of the year episode, one of my big goals for 2020 was to make the whole business run by one button. And this is one of my big projects that I have in mind to do that. You know, take all the manual FreshBooks and all that labor and all these giant lists of BS, make them go away, make it automated, build it into our system, customize it, clean, easy to manage, automated, we get paid, people can give us their money easily. That's the goal of any business, right? Just it's fine, just give us our money, make it as easy as possible. And I'm looking forward to scratching this off the list so that piece of the project is taken care of, because this is a really, really big one. You know, all the cool real-time WebSocket ham radio stuff is interesting, but this is important to business too, and so I really want to get it right.
That sounds good to me. You got me sold.
And we also have ideas for I didn't even get into this, but we have a certain business model right now. We've got basically two yearly plans. You have to pay up front for 12 months. That's kind of a non-starter for a lot of people, especially because the higher plan is really expensive. You know, our remote DX plan, that's our entry level, is $99 a year, which, you know, it's only $8 a month. When you put it that way, it doesn't sound like that much, but $99 a year, that's kind of a lot for people to kind of tackle at once, and especially if you're not sure if you want to try it. So basically, we only have yearly plans right now, and we'd like to be able to offer maybe a monthly plan at a premium so you can try it out. Or maybe you just want to sign up for 4 months out of the year when you can operate in the winter or something. Like, we want to try all these different things, and having this system in place will make that possible.
Yeah, I like that it gives you the ability to be creative in how you offer pricing. I think that's something that I wish we could do more at Design Collective. We're kind of stuck in the way that we are because of implementing a couple of things in a naive fashion. But I think that's something that I hadn't really thought about before coming to Design Collective, is that you could actually play around with billing and do a lot for your company in just a small tweak, like you said, possibly offering like a yearly billing option or a monthly one that's a little bit more expensive than yearly. There's a lot of options there, and especially, you know, every application, or a lot of, you know, most applications, especially across industries, have a different target audience that think differently about paying money, or that would pay different amounts of money for different frequencies. So having the ability to experiment with that, I think, is huge.
Further updates as this project progresses. It's come along very far in a very short amount of time. Of course, that last 20% is 80% of the work. So that'll be fun. But I'm looking forward to migrating people over to this and getting them on the bandwagon here. Plus Tailwind UI. I didn't mention I'm using Tailwind UI for all this new stuff. These great form views and list views and definition lists. Oh, man. Thank you, Adam Wathen, the one true CSS god.
Yeah, we've been using it a ton on our new app as well, and also in Design Collective in incremental improvements. It's sort of like it's great, right? Because we don't have a design team, we don't have a design system, we don't have a universal sort of language, right? For
you do have a design team. It's Adam Wathen and the other guy. His name is
Steve Shoger. Yeah, that's what I'm getting at, though. Is we didn't, but now we sort of do. We can follow, likeness aside, you know. We don't necessarily care about, especially our store admins and backends, being the most uniquely designed app. It just needs to be clear, concise, and it just needs to work, right? It needs to be easy to use. And so basically with Tailwind UI now, we do have a design team, or we do have sort of a language and styles that we can follow. And I think that's been the most beneficial. 100%, like, worth the money. It was just worth the money. We've already used it so much.
It was worth hiring them for $150.
Exactly. Yeah. So
you got your time's worth.
Exactly. You know, it's still growing. It's still, you know, there's some accessibility improvements that can be made, and there's some, you know, it's still like being improved upon, and that's totally fine in my book. I think maybe that's partly the most impressive thing about it, is that, yeah, we paid a one-time fee, and we just get updates as long as they continue to work on it. You know, so I guess like the agreement is they won't abandon it next week. But even then, you know, the way that it's built, like we talked about, that it's not just like drop in and never touch the code after that. The way that it's sort of like a jumping off point, I think, is huge. It's like part of the allure to me. But yeah, 100% worth the investment, because we've been using it a ton. This week's episode is sponsored by Tailwind. Right.
Seriously, Adam, give us a call.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm glad to hear about these improvements and how, like, you're feeling productive and feeling good, and you know, it like gives me positive energy. It makes me feel energized to just continue doing what I'm doing. So
really what I'm trying to do is talk myself out of feeling bad for rewriting something that already works. Like that's just never a good feeling. Like I already explained why it's better, why it's going to help us, why you know, this is the future, but it's still that thing in the back of your mind, like this is a waste of time. What the hell are you doing? Why are you rewriting this thing basically from scratch? Why are you trying to roll your own billing system, you dumbass? But I just gotta stay the course, and I know it'll be worth it. I know I won't regret it.
Yeah,
knock on wood.
I mean, you know your business, so that's the most important part. Well, I'm glad to hear all that, man. It makes me feel good. I feel better after having this chat with you than I did before having a chat with you. So I appreciate that.
Well, yeah, you didn't have to write the code.
Yeah.
You didn't have to look at the code.
Yeah. I didn't have to look at the code for sure. But I guess if anyone has any thoughts, questions, comments, concerns, any cookie recipes, just let us know. Reach out to us and let us know.
Cookie recipes.
Yeah, specifically. Let me know your cookie recipes.
My recipe is go to the grocery store and find the Girl Scout, and buy a couple boxes.
I missed the season already.
Secret recipe. Oh, it's still going on here.
I skipped out on them twice at the Safeway here, so I lost my chance.
Mm. Social distancing.
Yeah. Throw me the box.
I'll throw you them, but just throwing like those dollar coins at them.
The do-si-dos, no. They're going to break.
You can send us your cookie recipes on Twitter, DNCcast. Sean is Sean Washbot, and I am Shrugwell.
Everything we talked about today, links, articles, websites, services, anything we talked about should be in the show notes at dnc.show. So if you're looking for something specific that we talked about today, like Phoenix Live View Live components or the Live View hooks or even Ecto Chainsets and Maltsies, they're all going to be there. So head on over to dnc.show and check out those links.
And as always, we always post the show notes on spectrum.chat as well. There's a bunch of different chat rooms there for design, development, all that cool stuff. You can come over there and say hi. We'll get a notification in our browser because I actually enable those for that site and pretty much no other site. So stop in there.
And last but never least, thanks to Spec for having us, putting us out in the world. And if you're interested in other design and development related shows, head on over to spec.fm and check them out.
All right, man. Well, I guess I got to go spend some more time trolling LiveView channel in the Elixir Slack and helping people because this is my new job.
That's great. I'm going to go make some spaghetti. Some spaghetti.
Spaghetti.
Yeah.
We'll put a link to spaghetti in the show notes.
All right.
See ya.
All right, see ya.
Thanks again to Square for sponsoring this week's episode. Square makes it simple to start taking payments from your site with a customized user interface that matches the look and feel of your application. Check out the link in the show notes to learn more.